Welcome to All the Ways I've Failed. This podcast is recorded on the unceded lands of the Yugambeh people. We pay our respects to the traditional custodians and their continued connection to the land and sea on which we live, work and create. Hello there, my name is Beck Marshall-Say. I am a writer, an academic and the author of children's picture book Facing the Wave. All the Ways I've Failed is not only for writers but for anyone who creates, strives and fails along the way. Today, I'm talking with Nick Marshall. Nick is one of the busiest people I have ever met. Nick is a physiotherapist and co-owner of Surf Life Physio. He has provided physio services to top Ironmen and Ironwomen on the Gold Coast, Swimming Australia, Australian Junior Rowing, NRL referees, the 2021 Australian Olympic boxing team, just to name a few. He was the medical manager for the 2018 Commonwealth Games. He is an assistant professor. Nick has been an active surf lifesaver since he was a child and has completed the arduous Coolangatta Gold Race 10 times. Drawing on his background in surf lifesaving, Nick has created an inclusive surf lifesaving nippers program called the Albatross Nippers, which allows children with a disability to join the surf club and reconnect with their local community. In 2020, Nick received a Churchill Fellowship and the Australian of the Year Local Hero for Queensland Award. In 2022, he was awarded the Order of Australia Medal. Nick has published a book about some of his experiences called Included, the Albatross Nippers Story. Nick, welcome to All the Ways I've Failed.
I can't help but feel like it's going to be a disappointment from here. Hey, wow, what an intro.
I think looking at that, it seems hard to imagine that you have any failures, but naturally anyone who strives and achieves as much as you do, I'm sure has an equally impressive sort of resume of flops and failed attempts sitting behind them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For every kind of five things I probably do, it's probably one or two out of the five that come to success, but I think that's probably me, to be honest. I think one person summed me up a few years ago and said that I like to fail fast. So if I'm going to fail, let's fail quickly, see where the mistakes were, and then let's fix it and try and, keep moving or decide whether that's just not going to happen. So plenty of failures, trust me, plenty of failures.
And when you are sitting up, say, 11 o'clock at night, ruminating on your life, is it those successes that sit sort of forefront in your mind, or do you go back and replay the flops and the fails and the things that were missed?
I probably never think about the successes, to be honest. And I'm incredibly fortunate to get, I guess, an intro like I did, and then think, oh yeah, that's right. I did. How was that? I did do that. I do spend far too long overthinking where things have gone wrong in the past. And there's different bits and pieces that probably, I guess, resonate with me more and that stick in my mind more. But I think they also, in hindsight and with time, have allowed me to probably improve what I do now. You know, those failures at the time, probably they seemed catastrophic. You know, some of the ones that I think a lot about, but it does make me look at things differently now, approach things differently. And I don't think the failures have ever been at a point where they really were catastrophic, but at the time they felt like they were. But learning from them, they were probably the best thing to ever happen to me. So I guess that's the case for so many people, really, in terms of failing. But, you know, trying to take a positive away from it, at the time you certainly can't think there's any, or you certainly don't feel like there's any positives. But looking back on it now, and probably also having the beauty of hindsight, you know, you can kind of see, okay, well, that was actually a pretty good thing, a pretty good lesson to learn early on.
So before we unpack some of your impressive resume and maybe some of your big fails, what is something that your friends or family would just say that you are categorically no good at? What are you destined to fail at?
I'm destined to fail at saying no to people. I'm the worst person for that. I'm always saying, oh, yeah, I'll do that then. I'll do that. You know, if no one else can do it, I'll do that. So I am really, really bad at saying no. And everyone talks about it. Everyone tells me about it. When people say I'm really busy, it's really because of my inability to say no to people. So categorically horrendous at that. I mean, probably reading. I know we're talking about books here, but I've actually never read a book in my life, which is the irony of writing one and having actually never read one. It comes up in the book and I talk about it a little bit. I didn't know that I was dyslexic until I was about mid-30s. I just thought I was somebody that didn't enjoy books. And so, I have both my parents are lawyers. My sister's an editor, so they love books. They read their whole life, and they just thought I was strange that I didn't. You know, everyone at the time when I was young just thought I had too much energy and couldn't sit still, and probably now would have a diagnosis of ADHD, I guess, which is probably my superpower. But my other superpower is dyslexia. Like, I don't read, I do listen. The advent of audiobooks has been life-changing for me. That, yeah, they'd be the two things. I'm not good at saying no, and I'm certainly not a reader.
So what did you do when you were younger, and you've done a lot of study in terms of physiotherapy? Were you self-aware of your limitations with reading and how you were going to turn them into a superpower in terms of, you know, coping with the study load and processing information? Did you have that self-awareness back when you were at university?
I had a self-awareness at probably in grade 11 and 12, and then all through university, that if I listened in class and concentrated in class and could hear something or hear a story, or almost if somebody read from the textbook and I was listening to it, then I'd never forget it. And I became a bit of that annoying person that probably got away with doing less actual study than others. That's not to say I didn't work hard, but I certainly knew that if I listened intently in lectures and in class, I just remember it. I couldn't understand why other people couldn't. So it wasn't necessarily I was an awareness that I was struggling. It was probably a misunderstanding as to why other people couldn't do that sort of skill. You know, and I often tell the story, you could give me a paragraph to read and I'd probably struggle to remember it, unless I was almost in a vacuum with nothing else going on around me. But if you said the passage to me, then I'd probably remember it word for word. That became just something that I was good at. As a result of that too, I sort of stumbled upon it probably maybe in year 12 and certainly in university, that if I was going to do any study, and I certainly did study, I'm not somebody that said I did nothing. I had to study. We all have to study to get through university. But if I read stuff out aloud to myself, which everyone thought was incredibly strange and weird, I would remember it. And that's probably how I did study. You know, and I've since learned that that's a strategy for people with dyslexia, that they get an auditory response if they actually have to, physically articulate it, and then they hear themselves saying it. It's a different way of comprehending information as opposed to just reading it. So again, I didn't read that in books and I didn't have that explained to me, but I just sort of stumbled upon that. And then I guess in a funny kind of a way, that's what physiotherapy is, right? Physiotherapy, people come and see you every day with a problem. You're not really picking up a book to find out what's wrong with them. You're talking to them. And so having, I guess, dyslexia, or, at the time, like I said, I didn't know it was dyslexia, but having, an ability to talk to people, sit down, listen to their story, and I guess manipulate their story so that we could get the right answer became, I guess what I do every day. So I sort of stumbled into the perfect profession for me, where I wasn't book heavy. It was more talking to people, listening to people, and allowing people to just to talk and listen. And then I could, I guess work out what went wrong. So
it's amazing that you talk about you earlier, the benefit of hindsight, and looking back now, it's quite easy, I guess, to map that onto what you've done and what you've achieved and how you approach things and how you are looking at other people and their capacity to access services and things like that. And I guess the other thing that seems to very clearly have shaped where you've been or where you've ended up is your sports background. Can you tell me just a little bit about your background in sport?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'm probably reliving that now because I've got two daughters who are at those sort of pivotal ages where they're off to swimming training and off to board training and nippers and AFL and doing everything that, I guess a young person does. So both my parents were very sporty. They were both, like I said, they were both lawyers, but my dad played, semi-professional rugby, or in those days it wasn't professional, but at a very high standard. Sport was close to him in terms of rugby. My mum was a good swimmer at school, and, where we lived in Brisbane, we just naturally gravitated to swimming, in summer and rugby in winter. And I was just incredibly lucky too to grow up in sort of Chelmer, Indooroopilly, where John Carew, or Mr. Carew as we still called him up until his passing, had his swim school. So we joined a swim squad there, and at the same time that I had sort of joined, I was probably 2 or 3 years younger than another young fellow who joined, which was Kieran Perkins. And I guess for 10-12 years just shared the lane with Kieran, again in that kind of funny way. I didn't realize how unique an experience that was. He was just a young guy in our area that I grew up with. Our parents knew each other, and all of a sudden he goes on to be the greatest swimmer of all time. I didn't quite get there, far from it. But so growing up in a swim squad with somebody like that, you learn very quickly to work hard, and he was an incredibly hard worker. Swim train in the morning, you'd swim train in the afternoon. You'd look up to those guys. So those guys became, I wouldn't necessarily say your heroes, but the people that you looked up to. So look, I was a good swimmer at school level, and you know, it would go to state and national titles and make a couple of state team, Queensland teams. I always was part of the surf club. We lived in Brisbane, obviously, so it was an hour drive. We started on the Sunshine Coast at Metcalandra, and I absolutely loved it. So whilst I loved swimming, I guess at around 16, 17, I was by far the smallest, shortest, wimpiest little kid that, for whatever reason, didn't hinder me in the surf at all. I was able to stay far more competitive and successful in the surf in those kind of pivotal years. And so I probably lost my love for swimming and got a real love for surf lifesaving at that point. And here I am still involved. So it's been like a lifelong love. But I loved everything about it. You know, people make fun of me that if there's a party on, I'll gravitate to the oldest person at the party because I love hearing stories that the old people will tell. And that's what surf clubs are about. You know, there's always, every surf club's got an old salt that wants to tell you their story or tell you about stuff. And I'm fascinated by that. I'm absolutely fascinated. I love that component of surf lifesaving, which you don't get in, you know, competitive pool swimming. You know, when you talk about veterans and surf lifesaving, there's guys in their mid-80s. That are still, you know, rolling around in masters. And so I loved that component of it. So I probably then early on gravitated to surf.
So back in the early days as a kid, you're doing a lot of competitive sport. How do you cope with not winning?
Yeah, look, I see it now because I've been coaching for sort of 20 years. I would have been, as a coach, frustrated at myself. I'd get really, really down. And I don't know. There might have been one or two times over maybe a decade I cried, but I would be really down on myself. And it would take a week for me to get over things. And I would stew on it. I'd relive races. I'd usually, one of my probably shortcomings was overthinking things far too much. So, you know, I'd have done the race 500 times in my head before I got to the start line. And then I'd do it another 500 times, you know, overanalyzing it afterwards. So I probably didn't handle it well until I got a little bit older. And probably just had the benefit of coaches sort of saying, well, you know, these are learning experiences. They're not, you know, an end point or fatal. You know, you need to learn from it. And then I think that's probably the component that I love about coaching and I love about now trying to instill in so many young people is that I think early on I thought every loss was final and there was no way to recover from that. And probably, like I said, in those really formative years when I turned probably, I don't know, 13, 14, 15, some boys get big and strong and some don't. And I was the wimpy and small one. I think it was at that point where people said, this is the time now that you need to, you know, really focus on the things that you can change, attitude and technique. And so I've become massive on that as a coach, knowing that, you know, people are going to grow and mature. But if we can find something that we can continually work on and improve, yeah, I guess it lessens the potential for disappointment, you know, in a race situation. Surf can be a little bit demoralizing, you know, where it's just win or loss. You know, you can be the fittest, the fastest you've ever been, the best shape you've ever been, and you can come last. And then the next season you can have done the least amount of work you've ever done and win. You know, whilst that second year is amazing and you love it, that's what keeps you coming back. It can be the thing that sort of breaks you early. So I guess, yeah, I would really have stewed on it a lot early. But then as I got older and learned that sort of lesson of, okay, treat this as a learning experience as opposed to a, you know, a final or a fatal thing, it made it easier to keep involved.
And surf, for those who don't compete in surf, surf is a really unique sport because you are, as you said, you're contending not only with the work that you've put in or the work that the person next to you've put in, but you're contending with the elements, the conditions on the day, how well suited you are, but also just the sheer random nature of a wave rolling in favorably.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, a smooth path out for someone else.
Yeah. And you know, and you can read the surf better than anyone and you can be 1 meter to the left or right of somebody. They get out without getting their hair wet and, you know, you get two or three waves land in your lap or on your head and you're last. And you can really beat yourself up on that, can really get you down. Or, you know, like I said, sometimes you just have to put your hands in the air and say, well, that's the way life goes. And you know, somebody once said to me, it's probably 20 years ago or 25 years ago when I first sort of started being a physio, they said football or soccer, as we call it, is a good metaphor for life because you can dominate possession and you can, you know, have all the best players, but it can end up being a nil or draw. And that's what life's like. And I probably said to them at the time, well, I think Surf Life Saving's the better, you know, I guess, metaphor for life. You can be in the right place at the right time. And if you've got the skill set, you can maximize on it, or you can have everything going for you and just be a little bit unlucky. And you know, it's just not your time. So I do think it's a little bit of a metaphor for life. You need to be in the best shape you can so that if an opportunity comes your way, you're ready to capitalize on it. But equally, you need to understand that sometimes luck's involved and you just need to bounce back from that.
I love that idea of just equipping yourself the best that you can to take on what comes to you, because it'd be very easy otherwise to either beat yourself up too much to say, oh, well, it's because I'm terrible, I'm a failure, even though the conditions played an important part, or on the flip side, to sort of push responsibility away and go, well, oh, they got lucky, I got unlucky, it's not my fault.
No, that's exactly right. You know, you just need, if you can have that skill set to allow yourself when it comes your way to capitalize on it, but also know that, yeah, I've got to be resilient enough to know that it might not be my day today.
So you move out of your sort of junior sport and you become for a period quite interested in the professional Ironman circuit. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I left school, all I wanted to be was an Ironman. Hell bent on that. That was everything for me. You know, I had a physio degree or was studying physio, but had no intention of ever doing anything other than trying to be an Ironman. Unfortunately, look, and again, it becomes one of those fortunate things in the long run. I actually had a small bleed on my brain in the year 2000. So I just had a small aneurysm. That put me out of sport. And probably for 4 months, I, you know, suddenly realized, even if I became the most famous Ironman in the world, I've got a physio degree. I've got to do something with that as well. So at the end of that 4 months, all I ever wanted to do again, and you know, all I thought about in that 4 months really was trying to get back fit and race, you know, do some Ironman racing. But it did, in a funny kind of a way, reinforce the importance of me, you know, capitalizing on my physio sort of career. So look, I kept racing, I kept training. After that kind of health scare, I went from being, I'm only going to be an Ironman and Ironman's everything, to it's one thing and I really like it, but you know, I need to be serious about other things. So in that kind of way, that 4 months was the longest 4 months of my life. You know, you're not sure if you're going to live or die. And everyone's telling you, I had somebody I knew who had an aneurysm, and I had a grandmother who I never met who had an aneurysm and died before I was born. So, you know, you're getting all these horror stories and everyone's saying how lucky you are to find it. Forget about this surf stuff, you know, just, but that was still what I wanted to do. But I also knew, look, I've got to crack on and cash in on being a physio, because that's what my life's going to be.
When you started doing the Coolangatta Gold, which is an arduous race that perhaps you could speak to, was that when you were still sort of harboring dreams or expectations of being a professional Ironman, or was that a little bit of a pivot in focus once you started redirecting most of your attention towards becoming a physio?
The Coolangatta Gold went from, I think it might have been 92, 93, and then even they might have done a race in 1996. And then there was basically nothing for a decade. So through that period where I really desperately wanted to be an Ironman, I desperately wanted to be able to do the Coolangatta Gold, but there was no avenue to. It wasn't an event. And I guess so 5 years after that health scare, you know, was the first time they had it back on the agenda. In 2005 was the first year it came back. And, you know, I was still racing and you know, keeping fit and doing the normal summer. But, you know, I think it might have been the 2004 got announced that the Coolangatta Gold was coming back on. And when I'd been had the health scare, you know, one of those things had been, oh, I wish I'd had a chance to do a Coolangatta Gold. I'd love the Coolangatta Gold. As a kid, I ran beside Leachy as he ran past Broadbeach. For me, in my era, was a massive deal. You know, I watched the movie a million times. And those guys that sort of dominated that era were the perfect age for me to be inspired by it. So in 2005, when it was back on, I actually came home from the UK early to try and get fit for that race. Certainly wasn't as fit as you need to be, but was fit enough for any, or as anyone can be in a 5-hour race. And yeah, and then it sort of just sparked a love affair of it. You know, I loved that event. That's why the race, I think, meant so much to me. It was a chance so I could actually train for something, do it properly. And I loved it. I really did.
And so the race is typically 42 kilometres and it involves swimming, board paddling, surf ski paddling and running. So it's a multidisciplinary race. It's contending with the elements. You don't know what the conditions are going to be like on the day. It's something that you could take, you know, 4 hours, you could take 5 hours, you could take longer. When you're going into your first race, do you have a particular goal? Do you just want to finish and have that moment? And what keeps you going through the hours and hours of training to prepare for that first race in particular?
It's a good question. I guess that first time around, it was that real, I guess, desire to do it. I don't know that any of us really knew who was going to be, you know, what times people were going to go, how long it was going to take certain people. People had known that times had changed and the superstars had got faster, which happens in every single sport, and, you know, the evolution of training methods and all sorts of stuff. But I don't know that I ever had like a goal time. I remember a newspaper reporter talking to me about another athlete had predicted that they would do this particular time. And I remember thinking, wow, I ain't getting anywhere near that time. But yeah, look, I just really wanted to be able to be a part of it, you know. And I think, like I said, maybe 10 years earlier, when I just finished school, I'd have had this real burning desire to try and be, you know, at the front and win. And look, I was incredibly lucky. I think in that 10 years, I don't think I finished worse than 18th or something. So I was always hovering around that sort of top 10. But, you know, I never had, even in my wildest dreams, did I imagine myself running in the lead or anything like that. I just wanted to be a part of it and close enough in the mix so that you felt like you're part of something really special. So for me, it was just about, you know, thinking at the time what I needed to do mileage-wise, going long hours. I've always enjoyed kind of training on my own. It gives me a chance in, I guess, a crazy world to just think things through. And I probably am a bit of a deep thinker on those sorts of things. So the long hours sort of training, either in the dark or on my own or swimming or whatever, I actually really enjoy that aspect. You know, nothing particular, I guess, goal-wise was motivating me each morning. I was what I was going to do, so that's what I did.
And you have the, I guess, unique position of having completed 10 in a row. When you look back over those races, I guess the ones that stand out as really successful or the highlights moments, do they correlate with being the fastest, or were there other factors that made something feel like a really good race?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I probably the one that I enjoyed the most was one that I finished feeling amazing, but I didn't necessarily race incredibly well. I had a good finish, but I remember thinking crossing the line at the immediate time of crossing the line, thinking I'm not tired enough. But I really enjoyed the last sort of run leg. It gave me a chance to kind of soak it in. And I remember at the time doing that race and thinking, I ain't ever doing this race again, so enjoy it for what it is. And that was maybe race 4 or 5. So that was really enjoyable. But I don't think the ones that were where I crossed the line in best positions or that were fastest were necessarily the ones that I enjoyed the most. Not at all.
Do you think your experiences with sport set you up well or inoculate you against failure in any way when you begin to do things like going to business or, you know, setting up a Nippers program? Do you see a direct connection?
Yeah. I say this a lot to people. I don't think you need to be good at sport to learn the vital lessons from sport that you need for life. Like, sport teaches you resilience in my mind. And I think sometimes for the really, really successful athletes, maybe they don't get the lessons as much as the ones who aren't successful like me, because I think the ones who probably are a little bit more like me that try everything, you know, work really hard, but just aren't good enough really at the end of the day, you learn a skill set that you need in business. You need to be able to, like I said at the start, you need to be able to fail fast and pivot quickly to reestablish something, bounce back from something, you know, and be a problem solver. You know, if you're racing kids, you know, and you're in year 10 and they're 6'2" and you're 4'4", well, you need to work out a way to be competitive. You can't just wish and hope that you're going to grow at night. You know, you're going to have to work on other little bits and pieces that are going to make you better. Same with, you know, with those sorts of long races too. You've got to work out, well, I don't have the time during the day, you know, to train. I can only do early mornings. So what am I going to do to early mornings that might be a benefit to me? Or, you know, so in that regard, I find it really good. I definitely think that it builds resilience, definitely allows you to goal set and I guess have a clear focus on what you're aiming for. But also just, you know, like we spoke about earlier, also just understanding that sometimes you can do everything right you know, and do all the right things, tick all the right boxes, and it just luck can just not be on your side, and it doesn't work, and that's okay. And, you know, it's not fatal, it's not final. You just need to find another way and go back and, you know, look at things and how you could have done it different, or just be conscious of the fact that maybe you couldn't have done anything different, that luck sometimes is like that. You know, one of the things, although I learned this term in my working career, found it really interesting, the NRL referees, or some of the referees in the past, used to talk about what they call like black boxing things. So sort of like when an aircraft crashes, you know, you can go back and look at the black box and find out what went wrong to try and deconstruct, you know, the things that led to the accident. But you're not looking for that black box in the moment. You know, in the moment, you're trying to rescue the plane so that it doesn't crash or so something doesn't go wrong. And so that's, I've used that metaphor a lot in business, that sometimes you've just got to go through with failing, or you just got to go through with the plan. And if the plan doesn't work, don't chop and change and mix it around and have this sort of hybrid version unless, you know, it's absolutely necessary. Do what you'd plan to do, see how it went, and then you can black box it at the end to sort of work out, okay, you know, this was probably the moment where things really went bad. But like the pilot, if you're trying to, you know, if you're trying to find the black box while the plane's, you know, you're trying to right the plane from crashing, then all, you know, all manner of things are going to go wrong. So that's probably, again, like I didn't learn that necessarily directly in my own sporting life, but I've learned it with dealing with, particularly with the NRL referees, that's a real big strategy that they would use. Don't overanalyze a mistake you might have made just before, because then you'll make another mistake in the future worrying about the one you just made. See it to the end, and then at the end, deconstruct what could have been done different and correct it. So I do think sport is a really good in that regard, and it certainly has been for me, you know, almost certainly.
So you've got this great background in sport, you've set up your business, and then you decide to set up an inclusive nipper program, Albatross Nippers. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
We spoke earlier about, you know, I had dyslexia growing up, but I didn't know that I had dyslexia. I was just a kid, you know, that I didn't know there was anything different. But I didn't know anyone with a disability growing up at all. You know, I lived a pretty privileged life, really. I don't know why, but it just never... those sort of paths never sort of met, you know. And then I very early on was incredibly lucky to go into elite sport as a physio. So I didn't know much about disability at all, despite being a physio. But I was coaching at Nobby's, where, you know, where I've been sort of 17 years now. And there was a family that had one child in our squad who was a very, very good little surf club athlete, and then another child who had Downs. And it was only at that point that I realized that the other child couldn't join in. And I remember at the end of the season, the family coming up to me and saying, look, we really appreciate you, you know, including everyone in the family in your training sessions, but, you know, our other child can't do nippers because there's not an avenue for them to do nippers. So on nipper Sundays, you know, I've got one parent down one end of the beach trying to explain to one child why they can't do it while the other one's here doing nippers. And at the time, I guess it just opened my eyes. Like I said, I'd never come across this, and I'd never had any idea of how socially isolating it can be, you know, living with a child with a disability. And so it really kind of tugged at my heartstrings, but it also made me think, I think we could change something here. Like, I don't think this is going to be that difficult. That's the naive sort of positive physio attitude I probably had. So that winter, I just set about writing to people, talking to people. At the time, there were surf clubs, and there still are, that are doing, I guess I'd call them disabled days, which are, I guess, an opportunity for someone with a disability to come to the surf club and, you know, and ride boards and do nipper based stuff. But and that's fantastic. And so it's not me having a dig at that at all, but that's not what I wanted. I really wanted to have an avenue that everyone in every family could join up at a surf club and do exactly what their peers, their brothers and sisters, their neighbors all do. So that's why I was really big on, you know, calling it an inclusive nipper program, not a disabled program. You know, we don't hold it separate to nippers. It's just within nippers. And my goal is just to get every kid back in their own age group doing nippers with each other. So, you know, we started this program incredibly naive. I think everyone was naive in that, I think because I was a physio, everyone thought that I knew enormous amounts about disability. That's why they thought, yeah, trust Nick. He, you know, he's physio for Australian Surf Lifesaving Team, and he knows disability because he's a physio. He'll know what to do. And that wasn't the case at all. But I, you know, the feedback that I got early on, which was really positive, which kind of then had that forward, you know, mechanism of motivating me more, was that it wasn't a disabled program. Is that, you know, families were saying to me, yeah, we didn't want to come to a program that was designed for disabled kids. We just wanted to come to nippers where we were accepted and where people would understand that they might need to modify this a little bit or change that a little bit rather than have a whole separate activity. So that's how it kind of it came about. And it's been a learning experience for me. I mean, we're 10 years old now and I'm still learning all the time about how we could do things better or what would be, you know, what would be more advantageous for the surf club, for the individuals, for the families. But I think that's why it's been so well received, is that people know that I'm happy for it to fail in certain things and we can fix it and change it and improve it. So it's been a journey, been a learning journey for me.
I was going to say, you had this nice umbrella of sort of not knowing what you don't know that's got you started and, you know, thrown you into the deep end with it. Is there any point where you sort of realize that if this fails or flops, that it's not a personal failure, but there are perhaps others that might, is there an additional pressure of letting others down that worries you at any point? Or does that give you the resilience just to push through and problem solve?
Oh, yeah, no, there was plenty of like fear of failure moments. I mean, there still is, you know, they're constantly worried that you might be saying or doing the wrong thing, or you're doing something that isn't, you know, and that's the other thing with disability, in 5 or 10 years time doesn't look right. You know, it's almost like, oh, you were doing this, that looks terrible. So by the time it was the best possible thing for us. I'm constantly worried about what things might look like in the future. I was always worried that it was going to fail. I still am. You know, you're always worried that you might not get enough volunteers. You're always worried that an activity might, you know, I guess, scare a kid away and then not come back, or they have an ordinary experience, they fall off a board. But I guess one of the things, you know, and I'm always encouraged by what other families tell me, sometimes to the detriment of, you know, if another family then has a go at you about something. I remember one family, you know, on social media almost attacking me because I had to cancel it because the beach was closed. And, you know, I understand that they'd come a long way, but the beach didn't get closed until 8 a.m. when we got told, and we thought we were able to do just beach activities, even though the surf was big. But then when the beach got closed, Nippers got cancelled and I can't run it. And I said, Nippers. So they were quite aggressive online. And, you know, that kind of, that really tore me up for a while, thinking, oh, you know, how could I have done that different? But, I guess I just needed that family and other families to be aware that those sorts of things, every family who did Nippers that day went through exactly what they went through. And then when other families said to me, our whole goal is just to do exactly what every other family does. And every other family got disappointed and couldn't do Nippers. It wasn't like you said, albatross kids can't go, but everyone else can. So that's life. That's a life lesson. And I think that's been the other thing that sort of I've had at the back of my mind, keeping me not necessarily afloat, but positive, is that if someone has a crap experience, our own kids have a crap experience at Nippers some days. You know, some days they do get smashed. Some days they do get sunburned. Some days we can't get in the water, but that's just Nippers, you know, and that's the experience that we're after. We're after just everyone being the same. So there's definitely been fear of things being going bad and that sort of stuff. But I think also of being comfortable in that that's probably what life is. And as long as we make it safe enough that no one's actually going to get, you know, drowned or physically hurt, then things are going to be good, bad, and indifferent, and we'll make sure that we learn from whatever things sort of pop up.
And so because you don't have enough on your plate already, you take all of those good, bad, indifferent experiences, and you have written a book included about the Albatross Nippers story. What made you think that this was a good idea and that you could squeeze this into your schedule?
Well, yeah, so the book came about, there was a documentary made about the program called Included, and essentially that documentary went, we thought we were making this documentary. Well, I thought the documentary was being made just to showcase what the group achieved, and that the season that the documentary was made was following these kids because they formed a March Past team, and the March Past team was the first time children with a disability or living with a disability were able to participate in Nipper state titles. And it just so happened to be 50 years of Nippers in Queensland. So it all kind of just married up beautifully, and you know, and so I thought that was great. And then that documentary I thought would just be a little bit of YouTube footage that people might have as a resource moving forward. But then it just went crazy. Virgin Airlines picked up the documentary, got put on Virgin, all Virgin flights around the world. I had people messaging me saying they got a flight from New York to London, Virgin Atlantic, and they'd watched the documentary. And then so somebody approached me and said, you should turn this into a book, but you should pad it out with some, you know, I guess some history around surf lifesaving and why someone with a disability isn't involved, and you know, why girls couldn't join a surf club until 1980, and what's the reasoning behind that. And so I started to write a few things down, and I'd always written some things down as well. And then in, I guess it's late 2019, I was up, you know, fortunate to win the Australian of the Year in the local hero category here in Queensland. And that's when you get thrust in front of people who are, but that's when you get thrust in front of people who want to know your story. And so people were asking, you know, for my story and how it had come about and who I was and how I'd got to be where I was. And I got approached by a publisher who said, this would be amazing. Why don't you write me some things down? So I started to write a whole bunch of things down. And then COVID happened. And so the publisher who, you know, said they were going to publish a book about me, and it was off the back of the Australian of the Year, and this is what they do, and everyone would love to hear a Nippers story, and what a great story, you know, all Aussie tradition. Unfortunately, that publisher just, they got back to me early 2020 and just said, look, we just can't, like COVID's killed us. We're being inundated with different bits and pieces. Can we just, you know, pump the brakes on it? And I was like, yeah, no worries. You know, I had no intention of being an author. But then that kind of coincided with the fact that being a service business like physio, it was pretty hard for people with COVID, you know, or during COVID to come into the business. So I was going into work every day and kind of sitting on my hands, and I sort of thought, well, I'm just going to write it now. And, you know, if it's just something that sits on my desktop that no one ever reads, well, so be it. I've got to come to work 5 days a week. I'm not super busy. So I did. So I sort of wrote it out. I wrote a little bit of a history out. Went down all these rabbit holes to find out, you know, why certain things were about disability and why, you know, I guess para sport is where it is, and the history of sort of Nobby's Beach Surf Club. And, you know, again, sort of tapping into that sort of love of mine to talk to older people. And everyone at the time was more than happy to talk to you over the phone because everyone was stuck at their house doing very little. So I sort of came up with this book, and then I got back in contact with the publisher, and they said, look, if it's not going to be this year. You know, if it happens, it won't be this year, but we are very, very interested. We'd love to do it. So we're not saying no, but we're just saying no to this year. And being impatient, after I got off the phone, I just went, oh, well, I might as well see if I can find other people. Spoke to a few other people. Everyone was just kind of giving me like that, oh, can we just pump the brakes at the end of COVID? You know, we've had millions of manuscripts handed in during COVID. You know, you're 1,000,001 on the pile. So we're not saying no, but we can't do it now. So again, I got really impatient and I'd written it. So somebody put me on to an independent publisher. I had a third party person come and pay for that because they really wanted it to get across the line and have that story out there. And they want to stay anonymous, but they were incredible for me. So it all just sort of happened from there. You know, I say to people, it's no prize-winning piece of literature, that's for sure. But I think it probably highlights where we got to and how and why. And I also wanted just the book. The other thing that happened to me during COVID was just pre-COVID, I was going to a whole range of different surf clubs every weekend to run their inclusive programs. Because the program, you know, whilst it started at Nobby's and we'd run it at Nobby's for maybe 6-7 years, you know, probably in 2018, 2019, leading into that March Past team, but I was probably at 6 or 7 different clubs running these programs. I just wasn't home ever. And so COVID and writing the book was almost a way of me saying to people, here's what I did. I don't know anything more about this than you. You can do this. This is the, you know, almost the manuscript. Here's everything you need. Go for it. You don't need me at your club. You know, your club's got your own nuances and people to, you know, to work with. So it was almost cathartic in that sense because I knew post-COVID, I just, not that I didn't want to, but I just wouldn't be able to go to every club every weekend to run a program. So that was probably the underlying motivation for it as well, is to have something to kind of say, look, here's what you need to do. Here's how I did it. You know, you already run Nippers at your club. This is just another age group and you just need to have these things in place. So that's what probably motivated it also during that sort of period of time, knowing that at the end of COVID that you'd have something you could say to people, look, take this. And go and do something special at your club.
I love that idea that part of your motivation for freeing up your own time is to write and self-publish an entire book.
Yeah, a lot of stuff up here didn't really seem to translate that well, did it?
So you have, even with physio, a long history of, you know, service and problem solving and identifying a need and a problem and fixing it. What is your next project?
Well, wow. Next project. So yeah, just when I thought I didn't have enough things going on, I am actually going to run for Division 12 local government in the March 2024 elections. Now, I guess before anyone says, you idiot, like, why are you doing that? Over the last probably 4 or 5 years, and it's not just to do with inclusion, but there's been a whole range of things that I sort of thought, oh, look, I guess as a problem solver, as a physio in the local area, I mean, I think we found, did some kind of crazy statistic, like over the last 25 years or whatever, 70,000 local people in my division have accessed me for physio or have had physio appointments, not 70,000 individuals, but 70,000 times I've treated somebody with a 4218 or 4220 postcode. So you do hear a lot about the local area, you know, and as is the case, I guess, with physios, massage therapists, people pour their heart out when they're face down, you know, on a physio bed, and you find out, well, what's the issues or local issues that's going on. So I've had a real interest in that. I've got a young family, so we're at, I'm a swimming club president. I'm on the NIPA committee. I, you know, help out at the AFL club. Obviously, do a whole bunch of stuff at the university as well. So I do tend to come across a lot of people. I think I'm accessible. So I sort of thought, yeah, there's some things I'd really like to look at. I mean, I'm fascinated by some of the research that comes out of the UK about engaging young people who I guess have strayed into crime, and giving them purpose through sport and activity. And there's a really popular program in the UK called the Kicks program, which is a five-a-side soccer comp that allowed young people who become a little bit disengaged and who, you know, were re-offenders for crime, gave them purpose. And I think in our area, in Division 12, which has Pizzy Park and the skate park and, you know, the ovals, that we could have a really good go at having some of those competitions, you know, in skating and surfing and I guess in giving young people sport as an avenue to express themselves, you know, and if you want to express yourself and do it well, you've got to practice and you've got to train, you've got to commit to it, and then probably can't be out late at night doing the wrong thing. And so that's one of my things that I've been really passionate about wanting to try and implement, you know, and we're in an area where sport is a center, you know, I guess a central point of focus in Division 12. There's so many things going on active wise there. There's also things in terms of just beach accessibility that I can't do just as a one man band with the albatross. You know, I've got some ideas around a cage that lives underneath every lifeguard tower that has some portable beach matting and beach wheelchairs, which, you know, are compactable, and you could have a QR code that you put your details in and it opens it up so that it you know, you're covered under insurance and it's almost a free hire to access the beach in that regard. So those are sort of things that I was lucky enough in my Churchill Fellowship, when I got a chance to travel sort of around the world, to sort of see that other parts of the world do that better than us. And so some of those things I'm really looking to implement. You know, I hope if I get elected, I'm going to have to get elected first. And I'm not very good at the campaigning part, but in our local area, look at, you know, there's nothing catastrophic in our local area that I've got to drastically change. Our local area, you know, with our previous member, has been run really, you know, pretty well. But there's some things that I could put my own little sort of flavor on, I think. And I think having a young family in our area, having a focus of young families, and I probably represent the majority of people in the area, I think it's probably just something I'd like to do and want to do. So vote for me, I guess. There you go. There's a little political spiel.
I love that. This is probably one of your biggest, most public facing goals or aspirations, putting yourself out there, which naturally comes with a risk of failure. Do you think you are motivated when you, I guess, if you think about, look, this could fail, I couldn't get elected. Do you think the risk of doing nothing or the cost of doing nothing mitigates that to some extent, that it's better to try and fail than to see this gap and do nothing?
Absolutely. And look, that's probably, again, you know, when I say one of my weaknesses that I don't say no to things, one of the reasons I probably throw my hat into the ring so often is I don't ever want to be that person that's just sitting around whinging about something. Like if I think there's something that, or a skill set that maybe I have that can improve that, I'd rather have a go at improving it and, you know, it failing or not, you know, in this instance, not being elected, then just be that person that sits around and whinges and but does nothing about it. And so that's what's probably motivated me a little bit with this, you know, I guess running for council, is that I don't want to be that person that whinges that this should have been done or that should have been done if I haven't had a go at trying to do it myself. And sometimes you get into those instances and you realize why it hasn't been done, because there was a whole bunch of things that were somewhat hidden that you didn't know about, that other people didn't know about. But yeah, so that's been probably a big motivator. I'm certainly not a politician, so it's not like a springboard into local, you know, into state or federal politics or anything like that. It's more just you know, I love the local area. I love where we live, and I want my kids to be able to grow up here too. So is there something I can do to make that happen?
Oh, Nick, thank you for your time. All the best with your campaign. Obviously, people who are on the Gold Coast can vote for you if they are in Division 12. But outside of that, one of the ways that people can support you and what you're doing is by perhaps reaching out and getting a copy of Included. Can you let me know where people can find that?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, nothing like a good plug.
Just note, just shameless plug.
Shameless self-promotion plugs there. That's great. Yeah, look, the best place to probably buy the book is at albatrossnippers.com.au, which is just the website. And then, yeah, we'll mail you out a copy. All the money from the book goes back to the Albatross Nippers. So none of the money raised from the book goes to anything other than keeping the program free of charge for all the kids. It's not a profit or money-making, I guess, avenue for us at all. But it's a nice way of avoiding having to write grants or having to have barbecue sausage sizzles to raise money. You can buy a book, find out more about inclusion, the Gold Coast, surf clubs and surf lifesaving, and then also support us as a program.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again for your time. And like you said, hundreds of failures lead to some pretty impressive successes with you. So I hope you have many, many more failures and some pretty brilliant, some pretty brilliant successes. Thanks, Nick.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to All the Ways I've Failed. You can find details about our guests and their work in the show notes, and you can find me on Instagram at All the Ways I've Failed or at Beck Marshall Say. Please rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts so that others can hear the beautiful and generous stories of our wonderful guests.